Woodhull, Carmel. It was on the 17th of March, St. Patrick's Day, that the eight sisters set off from Thicket to begin the new Carmel. They ranged in age from the late 20s to old Mother Mary of St. John, who was 87. She had known what it was to begin new foundations in her earlier years, and although by that time she was finding walking increasingly difficult, she was very much on the spot mentally and could give good advice. Mother Mary of St. John said of herself that she was coming to pray rather than to work. She didn't realize that one of her special gifts was to be such a lovely, supportive presence in any community, and something that was to be of great value over those first years. Eventually she returned to Thicket, when she began to need more expert nursing. She lived to be well over 90. The sisters went by car, driven by kind friends. We waved goodbye to them, and Godspeed. Both they and we found the parting very hard. Although we were glad that a new Carmel was being founded, where prayer and praise would be going on all the time, and where we knew the sisters would be happy, the cost to us all was very great. We who were left at Thicket felt utterly bereft. I remember going round the house, which now seemed so empty, later that day, and seeing the pictures gone from each of the eight cells. We all have a small picture on the door of our cell to indicate the occupant. Work had already been rearranged so that the daily chores were covered, but the sight of the choir stalls and refectory places with no one in them kept reminding us that we had lost more than one-third of our community. The sisters who went on the foundation had so much to think about that they probably didn't feel the loss so acutely at first. They were busy getting the new house in order, lighting paraffin stoves in the rooms to try to warm them, preparing for the opening ceremony on the 19th, and generally getting their bearings. The directors and sisters from the centre were kindness itself, and came to the door now and again to see if anything was needed that they could supply. They greatly appreciated the coming of the Carmel to Wood Hall. It added a whole new dimension to the work of the centre, a praying presence. Bishop Wheeler was overjoyed when he came to sing the first Mass on the 19th of March, the Feast of St. Joseph, a day we have kept as a very special anniversary ever since. So also was Father Paul White, who had encouraged us to make the foundation. Everything in the house was small and cheap or homemade, but it was a beginning. The sisters had come, the regular life of prayer had begun, and the new branch of the Tree of Carmel had sprung forth and unfurled its leaves. It was in June that we again had disturbing news from Ashcott. Mother had become very ill, and Father was tottering around trying to nurse her. Again there was much heart-searching, but I soon realized that something had to be done, and done quickly. So this time it was I who made the long journey by coach from Yorkshire to Somerset. I filled a suitcase with all the things I thought might be useful or as a treat for my parents, things like tins and jars of foodstuffs that were very heavy, so that I could scarcely lift the case. It would have been far more sensible to take some money to buy the things when I got there, but I didn't realize that at the time. When I reached Cheltenham, where I had to change coaches, and was hauling this heavy load along, a young lad of about 11 ran up and offered to carry it for me. This was a huge relief, but I was so unused to the ways of travellers that I just thanked him very much and got into the new coach. It was only after we'd moved out of the station that I realised that the poor boy had carried my case in the hope of a tip, and most probably spent his free time earning his pocket money like that. I felt miserable, but there was absolutely nothing to be done about it by then. I just hoped that the incident hadn't put him off nuns for the rest of his life. and I have prayed for him so often since that day. It was a beautiful summer day, and the coach was travelling due south. It was nearly 20 years since I had been on a bus, but somehow I didn't feel at all strange. I looked out at the English countryside, noticing the place names and the features of the landscape. It was all new to me until we began to get into Wessex, and then a great feeling of familiarity and homecoming came over me. The grass seemed to become greener and brighter. There were apple orchards, with their trees bent over by the wind. Gloucestershire passed, then, yes, Somerset, the Mendips, with their often dramatic outcrops of rock and their patches of woodland. I was nearly home after all those years. I had never thought I would see any of it again. I even had a glimpse of the sea at Weston-super-Mare, because the coach called there before going on to Bridgewater. Although I was anxious about the state my dear parents might be in when I reached Ashcot, my heart was full of gratitude for this wholly unexpected happiness. When we stopped at Bridgewater, there beside the road stood a great friend of the family from my childhood days, Mrs. Bartlett. She had promised to meet me in her car, and there she was, with her rosy apple cheeks, big smile, and the smart high-heeled shoes she'd always loved to wear when she was dressed up. I was amazed at how little she had altered in appearance over the almost 20 years since I had left home. She soon heaved that ridiculously heavy case into the back of her car, and before long we were speeding through the familiar villages, talking as we went. Until I heard her voice, I hadn't realized just how much I had missed the Somerset way of speech. It sounded so musical, and so much more like American than I had ever noticed before. I suppose that many of the Pilgrim Fathers would have been Wessex men. And so it was that in that golden sunlight of a late afternoon in June, I arrived back in Ashcot. We drove up the lane to a big back gate. It opened as if by magic, and out bounded a handsome young man, well over 6 feet tall, who gathered me into his arms for a quick hug, and then picked up that hefty suitcase as if it had been a handbag. It was Julian. He had dashed home when he heard how ill Mother was, and had arrived not long before me. I think he had hitchhiked, his usual mode of transport at that time. Up the stone flagged courtyard, oh so well remembered, I walked, following him into the hall, which looked dim after the bright sunlight outside. There it was, just as it always had been, the heavy oak beam supporting the ceiling and the upstairs rooms, the twisty stairs, the coats hanging on a row of pegs against the wall. What used to be the jam cupboard, where the mice used to get into any pots not covered with a piece of wood, had been opened up and made into an attractive alcove that it must originally have been. Otherwise, little had changed. My mind was almost in a daze, and yet in a sense ultra-perceptive, as I went into the living room. A white-haired man was seated in the big chair by the empty fireplace. He didn't at that moment attempt to rise. That would have been too lengthy a process for this most precious encounter. I bent over him and gave my father a kiss and a big hug. "I have dreamed so often that you came home," he said, "but it's never been true before." I went across the hall to the other room. They had been using this as a bedroom since he had broken his hip. Neither of them could manage the stairs any more. Mother lay there in bed, looking worn and grey, and obviously very poorly. She had a lot of pain. Father had spent hours just sitting on the side of her bed, holding her hand. They were still so much in love. Soon I was bustling around in the kitchen, getting out the things I had brought with me, and making a meal for us all. Julian was a great help, telling me where everything was. I saw that he really had changed very little in character from the four-year-old I had left behind when I entered Carmel. Mother had been visited by the doctor earlier in the day, and had pills of various kinds that she was supposed to be taking. Both she and Father didn't believe in taking pills. "Let's have the blue ones today," Father would say brightly. She understood about the insulin, but even with that, I was never too happy about the way she did it. She used the same clean mortar to rinse the syringe until it had a green edge all around the top. Yet she managed to do the injection for well over 20 years. Perhaps hers was a charmed life. In a few days there was a marked improvement in Mother's condition, and Boo rang up to say she was coming over from Street with the children. This was normally the best of tonics for the grandparents, but because of Mother's illness, they had feared that the noise and exuberance of children would have been inadvisable. It was the day the bread man called. Not the baker with his own fresh-baked wares of my childhood, but a van that brought round mass-produced loaves and some cakes and pastries. Father insisted I bought plenty of these buns and some sausage rolls for the children. Grandpa's party, he called it. I discovered that he always did this if he knew they were coming, and no doubt the children had no difficulty in emptying the plates. That was another very poignant day for me. I had not seen Boo since our early days at Thicket, before she was married, and now she had an already large family. Her husband David I hadn't seen since he was a schoolboy. They came in an elderly car and spilled out into the paddock, the two boys dashing straight off on some game. They were about 8 and 10 years old. Then came two fairy-like figures with long silky hair, one of them so like Boo at that age that I could hardly believe my eyes. Melinda and Julia looked at me shyly, as if I had dropped from another planet. I suppose I did look a rarity in my brown habit, although they were accustomed to seeing nuns in church and at school. Then came Edmund, the baby, just asserting himself in his new role as a toddler. He was captivating, with his wise dark eyes and thoughtful expression, as he calmly summed me up. And there was my dear Boo. We just wanted to look at one another for the first few moments, as time stood still and the years slipped away. We had been together so often in that paddock in our childhood and growing days, and now her children were enjoying the same pleasures in the same place. Her relief at my coming was beyond words. She had been torn apart with Mother so ill, yet her loyalties to her husband and children kept her from being able to help. It was an agony that both she and I were to have to live through over the coming years, quite often, the others too, as our parents became progressively more frail and in need of help. Yet in their way, they were a determined and obstinate couple. They always felt sure that they could manage and were perfectly all right. Father was 18 years older than Mother, but hers was a less robust constitution, so there were times, like this one, when they just had to give in. In one way, it was hard to see them both so frail and failing, yet all the same we felt proud of their courage and tenacity. They both still had that wonderful gift of being able to enjoy life. A flower, a bud on a treasured plant, a sunset, a goldfinch on a thistle, any one of the daily wonders surrounding them filled them with delight and joy. Even things read in the paper or a book they would share with happy zest. "Listen to this, Mum," Father would say, as he sat in his chair, glasses perched precariously, because one arm of them was replaced with a piece of twisted wire. And then he would read out some funny anecdote for her pleasure. Boo and I had so much to discuss and to remember, and as we still do whenever we get the opportunity to speak together on the phone, we found ourselves full of gratitude for our parents, our home, and all that we had received from our upbringing. We recalled what Father had said to us so often in days gone by. "Write two words over your bed, patience and courage," and his other recommendation, press on with courage and fortitude. I think that one was a legacy of his war years. He was certainly living out his own advice before our eyes. On another occasion, Simon came over too, with his wife and two children. So my errand of mercy had its very happy side, in that I was able to see my family again, and meet for the first time all my little nieces and nephews. Once mother began to improve, I was able to appreciate these bonuses better, although at the same time I couldn't forget that my community back in Carmel were doing the jobs for me and longing for me to come back. Someone said to me recently, and I found it so true, that the stupendous and the trivial are inextricably intertwined in our lives. Even in the greatest moments and experiences, one part of us is worrying over some tiny detail, whether we left enough water in the kettle, or if we'd remembered to switch something off. Maybe part of the lesson I was trying to learn from my parents now was the ability they had of enjoying life to the full, and not worrying about something that at that moment they could do nothing about. In other words, to live in the present moment and make the best use of it. The village had already changed a good deal over the almost 20 years that I'd been away. When I left, there were lots of small orchards like our own, behind farms and in between the houses. These had now almost all disappeared and had been replaced by clusters of bungalows, each with its brightly coloured and well-tended garden. The view from the front rooms in our house was quite different. The cow byre and the midden that had been in the foreground had gone, and the cottage now stood in its place, with a goldfish pond and pretty shrubs. The couple living in it had been children when I last saw them. I felt a bit like Rip Van Winkle. Further down the lane, the huge chestnut tree and the beech, both of which had been landmarks in the village, had also gone. Bungalows had grown up on that land too. The occupants had planted other smaller trees, laburnums, red maize, and various flowering shrubs. And while I was feeling sad at the loss of the big trees, Father was telling me of the beauty of these new ones, and the colourful sight they made as he looked out from his window. He was so remarkably young at heart still, and I blessed him for it. Already the village was home to a much larger population. In fact, it was fast becoming a dormitory village. Gone were the days when everyone knew everyone, and a stranger was an object of interest and discussion. Yet a good deal of it still remained the same. I could still see Pedwell Hill from the bedroom windows, and had only to walk to the top of the nearby lane to be able to look across to Glastonbury Tor. One quite striking change, though, that I noticed, was that it seemed everyone now had a bathroom, flush toilet, car, or more than one, telephone, refrigerator, and a television. Within a few more years, these were to be joined by a deep freeze and a video. In the gardens, motor mowers and power tools had appeared, so a lot of things that had been non-existent in village homes had now become basic necessities. My parents had never had a car, and would never be able to afford a telephone or television. It was one of their children who insisted that they had a phone put in, as they became more frail, and in fact had it installed for them. Father was perfectly certain that they did not need it, and eyed it with disgust at first, but very soon it became a great joy to him, and he realised he could talk to any of his children in their own homes, and that it was really a very good idea for housebound people. Their television was also given to them by Father's brother Harry and his wife Lily. They kindly kept up the payments of the rental and license until they died. Several things, though, had virtually disappeared from the home scene, the most notable one being the hearth. All down the centuries, and during my own growing years, the words home and hearth were very closely connected. Hearth meaning and being the very centre, the heartbeat of home. However poor the home, even the veritable hovel that many families lived in, the parents and often small children gathered fuel to make a fire. Food was cooked on it, and in the cold winter evenings, everyone gathered round the last embers for warmth and a glimmer of light. In the homes of the better off, the fire would be in the living room, and everyone would be gathered there. Children would be doing their homework, or reading, or playing games or music. Fathers would be reading the paper or a book, mothers often making or mending garments, grannies knitting. I felt sorry, and rather apprehensive, when I saw that this symbol of home, family and security had almost gone. The danger, to my eyes, was fragmentation. Until recently, the ability of a man and woman to make and control fire was a sign of civilization. Today there are adults leaving universities who have no idea of how to light a fire. It is no longer a basic skill. Maybe it's just something they will never need to know. New skills have replaced the very down-to-earth, elemental expertise of former ages. Life was tougher, but simpler. I stayed at Ascot for 3 weeks, by which time Mother was on her feet again, frail but determined. It was hard to leave them, almost harder than when I'd first left home, because they were now so needy. But we were all three brave as we could manage, and they did in fact cope for some time before the next real illness. Meanwhile, I received a most loving welcome back at Carmel, my other family. Chapter 22, Creating a Garden. During the following months, there were some changes made in the community at Wood Hall. Bridget was not at all well there, so she came back to Thicket. Later, one of the others had a fall and broke her arm, and she too returned. Each of those was replaced by another sister. One found the life in a new, pioneering situation difficult to cope with. For various reasons, the new community went through a time of rearrangement, and therefore so did we. This had been anticipated. It would have been impossible to judge beforehand exactly who was needed at Thicket, and who would be the most suited to the new task of making the foundation. It was lovely for me to have Bridget back. She soon regained her health and youthful bloom. The prioress was glad to have her back at Thicket, for she was gifted in many ways, and a helper for her. She stayed on, and has been at Thicket ever since. It was not until early next May, just over a year after the new house was founded, that our prioress asked me if I would be willing to go to Wood Hall. Somehow it was all so simple. I loved Thicket, and the sisters there, and the beautiful garden. Yet when the call came, I knew I was quite ready to pack my very few belongings and set off on the next stage of my journey. We had a little party in the kitchen, scenes of so many of my labours, and everyone gave me helpful suggestions and ideas for what to do and take. By this time we had become more accustomed to the ideas of sisters going and coming back, so we made jokes about how long it would be before I returned. This blunted the sharp edge of my parting, or at least helped to obscure it from our immediate view. Events moved swiftly, and before the end of May a friend's car was at the door, and my little box of belongings was being put into the boot. Most of my luggage consisted of plants that I had dug up from the garden, because I knew the Wood Hall garden was as yet just a rough, stony hillside. This caused some merriment amongst my community. Burnham Wood coming to Dunsinane, and she's taking half the garden. How will the driver see the way through all those leaves? And other comments. But I wasn't going to leave any behind after having gone to the trouble of digging them up. A last goodbye, and then I was speeding through the Yorkshire villages towards Wetherby. The couple who were driving me were very kind, and managed to make everything seem as normal as possible, as if I were just out for the day. They chatted amicably and pointed out various places of interest as we passed. It was not a long drive, less than an hour, and soon we were on the bumpy lane into Wood Hall. I had last seen it on one of my painting and scrubbing expeditions, when snow covered the surrounding fields and the trees and hedges were bare. Now all was green with that lovely first brightness of spring, the new leaves freshly unfurled, and the verges full of wild flowers. When we reached the new Little Carmel, and I saw its bare pebble-dashed frontage, I realised how difficult and different it was all going to be from Thicket with its spacious rooms and solid walls. But I knew that the inner spirit would be just the same, and that it would still be home. Before we had pulled up at the door, there wasn't even a porch in those early days, it was thrown open, and two of the sisters came hurrying out to meet me. We quickly unloaded the car, while my kind friends were given some tea. I wanted to get my plants into a sheltered corner until I could put them into the ground. Then I had a great welcome from the rest of the little community. It was indeed a home from home, in that they were all the part of our original group at Thicket. I knew them all so well, as they did me. I was shown my new cell, the choir, the refectory, all very small and poor after Thicket, but adequate for the time being, while we were so few. The kitchen was unbelievably tiny, with a two-burner paraffin stove for all the cooking. Sister Mary Bernard had mastered its ways, and could make the bread and cakes in a little oven. Two loaves and a tray of brown bread buns were cooling on a rack as I went in to have a look around. And there was dear old Mother Mary of St. John, coming along with her staff. She didn't want a walking stick, because she said it would make her bend over. She liked a tall staff instead. I had cut it for her while she was still at Thicket, from a young ash sapling. She was so pleased to see me. After all, she'd been my prioress for most of my time as a nun, and my novice mistress as well, during my years of initial training. She was to be a support to me now, as I began this new phase of my life, and I was soon appointed to help her in everyday things where she needed someone at hand, now that she was old and infirm. Although the same orarium was followed us as at Thicket, we had to be more flexible and ready to change things round at short notice. Because we shared the chapel with the ecumenical centre, our main church service of the day, Mass, might be at any hour from early evening to midday, occasionally even in the morning. We had to fit in with whatever group of people happened to be staying at the centre on that day. This could be quite difficult at times, particularly if we didn't know beforehand exactly when it would be. There was bread to be put to rise, we always made our own then, and the printing press to ink up. It was no joke to get everything ready for printing and then have to break off for an hour, with the ink going sticky on the rollers. The printing was our livelihood. The reverse side of that particular coin was that very often some of the best speakers of the time were at the centre, giving lectures or courses in the chapel, and we were able to be present and to profit from the talks. In that way we made friends who still keep in touch today. The garden was simply a wide sweep of hillside full of stones. There were just a few inches of stony soil over solid rock, covered with wild grass and brambles. Everyone said we'd never be able to grow anything on it. Yet when they had been at Wood Hall for just a year, the sisters had started a vegetable patch, and some beans and cabbages were already looking promising. The far side of the hill was a tangle of natural woodland, mainly ash, sycamore, and witch elm, with an understory of spindle trees and hawthorn. It was a long time before we were able really to explore it and to discover some of its secrets. Our main concern was to clear the area near the house and on the sunny side of the hill, and to plant trees, shrubs, and an orchard, as well as the vegetable patch. All around the house was as it had been left by the bulldozer that had levelled the bank and the land for the building. There were jagged pieces of broken rock lying everywhere, and a steep bank of debris faced the windows immediately outside the cells. Certainly a challenging sight. Not many of us were strong enough for garden work, and even those who were had to help with indoor tasks as well, so we could not spend as much time out of doors as we should have liked. In fact, gardening time had perforce to come fairly low down the list of daily priorities, but what time we could find, even sometimes a bare 5 minutes, we would use, so that very gradually, almost imperceptibly, a transformation began to take place. Sometimes a relation or friend sent a gift of cash to get something for the garden, and I would pore over gardening books and catalogues so as to be able to choose the most suitable plants and shrubs for such inhospitable conditions. The hillside was high up and very windswept, which made it bleak and wintry, even when the surrounding lower-lying villages had begun to show signs of spring. No one looking at the garden today could ever imagine what it was like. There were lawns full of daisies in summer, cowslips in springtime. Shrubs and flowering trees give colour and interest all the year round. The rough, rocky bank is clothed with plants and shrubs, and many weeds too, or rather wild plants. There's an orchard that yields enough fruit to keep the community in apples for the best part of the year, and some over to give to anyone who comes. And then, further along the hillside, a large and productive vegetable garden, with greenhouses and rows of soft fruit, giving ample evidence of the value of perseverance. It's all been done step by step, almost inch by inch. Each autumn we bought, or had given us, one or two fruit trees, every one of which could only be planted by digging the hole first with a pickaxe, cutting into rock, and then filling the cavity with compost. Nothing was wasted, everything was composted, because this thin layer of soil dries out very quickly in summer, so anything that will make a mulch is eagerly sought after. I'd long known that where there is little or no soil, cultivation will eventually make some. There were times when it was hard for us to believe this, but in the end we saw it was true. 500 years ago, the original Thicket Priory was one of the many thriving monasteries in Yorkshire, some of which were for men and for women. They were centres of prayer, learning and expertise, and helped to create the Yorkshire we know today, with its sheep grazing and cultivated fields. Few people were aware, as we struggled to get the new little foundation on its feet, that the new Yorkshire monastery was springing up in this quiet place near Wetherby. The ones who did know were overjoyed and deeply appreciative. It is to their encouragement and assistance, as much as to the tenacity and courage of the small founding group of sisters, that we owe our being there today. The monks and nuns of those olden days must have struggled with the same problems that beset us. They too had to hack their way through rocks and slash at brambles with hand tools similar to the ones we had. We never had anyone to help in the garden, or for that matter in the house either. We did all our own decorating and joinery. Sister Catherine made some wonderful cupboards and shelving, and repairs of all kinds, as well as making our clothes and building retaining walls and steps. Only for electrical or plumbing problems that were really beyond our competence were we obliged to get help from outside. We could not have afforded to pay anyone. It was as simple as that. We had no power tools, just a few basic and trusty things such as the pickaxe, spade, fork, hammer and saw. in fact the very same equipment that those nuns and monks of old would have used. Indeed, everyone, until the last comparatively few years. Those first years were not easy. There were difficulties of all kinds, some of them having no simple solution. At one point, the prioress and her council at Thicket began to feel it had all been a big mistake, and that we should have waited longer before making the foundation. They had heard about the services held in the chapel for the groups of young people, and some not so young, who came to the courses at the centre, bringing their guitars and drums, flutes and clarinets, plus any available instruments, to accompany their enthusiastic singing. Thicket feared that this might impinge on the silence and solitude that is so much a part of our Carmelite life. Had they been present themselves at these services, they would have realized at once the great faith of our participants, and the spirit of prayer and praise that was so evident to us. When one has only hearsay to go on, everything becomes distorted. So there was a lot of suffering, both here and at Thicket, over this and similar issues. It was all part of the growing pains of a new foundation. Saint Teresa used to say that if everything went too easily when she made her foundations, it was not a good sign. Certainly we didn't have it easy here, yet there were very many consolations, and deep within us a peace and tranquillity, as we all felt that all shall be well, and all manner of things shall be well, as Julian of Norwich said. So we resolutely went quietly on, praying and working. It was a very happy day for us when our first postulant asked to join the community. It must have been a great leap of faith for her, considering the smallness and poverty of the house. Nevertheless, she came and she stayed. It was the beginning of January when she arrived, and very cold. One of the funny anecdotes she enjoys recounting of her early days here was how she used to put her anorak on in bed in the effort to get warm enough to sleep. She brought with her anything she might feel of use to us when she sold her house and belongings. It was put to good use around the house, and some of it is still going strong to this day. Those years were a testing time and a growing time for all religious orders and congregations, as the new approaches of the Second Vatican Council slowly opened up windows and doors of thought. Attitudes began to change, emphases shifted. When you have lived as long as I have, it is quite astonishing to see just how radically people's way of looking at life, the church, even themselves, have altered in one lifetime. The most important things haven't changed, of course, nor can they. Reality and truth will always remain. But the way we see things and the expectations we cherish differ from generation to generation, even from people to people. I like to think we can see more clearly today, but no doubt people have thought the same since creation began. Certainly for us in Carmel, a few welcome changes came about in some areas of our lives, just as they did in the world around us. Record players and cassettes began to appear, so that those of us who had loved instrumental music were able to enjoy it again on occasions. The heavy iron grills through which we used to see our visitors were removed. Lighter habits were made for the summertime, and wonder of wonders, tea and coffee made their way into everyday life. The important things remain, as we hope they always will: prayer, silence, community life. It was the outer trappings of the life that were and are being updated. In order for the monastery to be fully recognized and ratified, we had to have sufficient room for a minimum of 13 sisters, so we needed to build on more cells and enlarge the tiny kitchen and refectory. It all seemed a daunting task because our printing work was barely keeping us afloat financially. But again, people helped, and God blessed our efforts. We began to build, even though at the time we hadn't enough money to pay the first instalment of the builder's bills. but when the day came for the bill to arrive, there was just enough in the bank to cover it. And so it went on until the sales were completed. It was quite miraculous, and we saw it in that light. Gifts of money came, or gifts in kind, when our earnings were not sufficient. One very wonderful present was given to us by the mother of one of the sisters. She had seen the little oil stove in the kitchen. "An army marches on its stomach," she quoted, and she gave us our Aga cooker, which has been at the heart of the home ever since. We had had an Aga at Thicket, so I already loved cooking with one. Maybe it was not such a far cry from the range that we had had at home. Before long, another postulant arrived, bringing joy to us all. Things were still fairly primitive. The new cells were just ready, but so much remained to be done. It was when she was a novice that we first ventured into keeping goats. People had told us that our land was the very place for goats. There was lots for them to eat, so their upkeep would cost little. In fact, they would help to tidy up the garden and woods, and we'd have plenty of milk, which would be good for everyone. The goats duly arrived, round about Sister Catherine's Silver Jubilee, so they were called Silver and Jubilee. Both were British sarnans, but very different in character. Silver was a thoroughbred, perfect in all her points, and was accompanied by the most endearing little kid, which we called Goldberry, after one of Tolkien's characters, but she was rather obtuse. Jubilee was just the opposite, with her rough coat and oddly shaped figure. Her job before coming to us was to run on the hills with the flocks of sheep and act as foster mother to any orphaned lambs. Unlike the handsome but somewhat dim-witted Silver, she was highly intelligent and great fun to be with. She arrived first, so our attempts at milking began with her. It was Sister Melanie who began to care for the goats, although she had grown up in the city and had never milked anything before. She loved animals, so we knew that she would do the job well. In the book about goat keeping, it said that if the goat could be persuaded to stand on a bench, the operation would be much easier for the milker, as goats are quite low on the ground. Goats enjoy climbing, so it was no problem to get her to stand on the garden bench, and Melanie began to milk. However, no milk came, despite helpful hints being read out by the other sisters. Goats are sociable animals and like to be talked to. Sister Patricia spoke gently to Jubilee, who replied with a polite meh, revealing as she opened her mouth the heads of my purple lupins, on which she had been browsing to my chagrin a few minutes before. It says here the goat should feel relaxed and comfortable at milking times. Patricia read out, "Relax, Jubilee," she urged. Whereupon Jubilee promptly sat down, so that was the end of the first attempts at milking. We really enjoyed goat husbandry. They lived at first in a small hut in the garden, which was normally used as a hermitage for prayer. Sometimes we built a real house for them, with breeze blocks, containing everything a goat would wish for, and providing storage space for their winter feed. We worked together on this for some time, and when it was complete we had a housewarming. We lit a bonfire outside in which to roast potatoes, and had our dinner up there. It was all freshly whitewashed, and had not yet been lived in by the future occupants. Both the goats and little Goldberry greatly enjoyed the day. They really love human company. The next day they couldn't understand why we weren't going to do it again, and kept calling for us all day. Unfortunately, as time went on, the goats discovered the vegetable garden. And although this was surrounded by 3-foot wire netting to keep the woodland rabbits out, the row of tender young greens and lettuces soon had the goats bounding over it. Goats and vegetables simply cannot live on the same patch. Sadly, we had to sell the goats, but the director of the centre bought a cow for us as a gift in honour of his own Silver Jubilee of ordination. She too was therefore called Jubilee. 3. The Law of the Land. Jubilee was a gentle Jersey cow, very beautiful with her big brown navy eyes and curly topknot. Although small, she seemed quite large to us after milking the goats. She settled in straight away, living in the goat house, suitably adapted for her. She seemed to know instinctively what she should do as a monastic cow, and became part of the family very quickly. She too loved company, and would watch the people coming up to the chapel with great interest. I was cook at the time, and used to make butter and cheese with her rich Jersey milk, as indeed I had with the goat's milk. The butter was usually successful, but the cheese varied considerably. Once it looked about to explode, so we had to bury it. Another time we were very proud of it, and gave some to a monk who was giving us talks to take home to his community. We never heard a word about it from them, and trust that they all lived to enjoy it. We had an electric fence to divide the field into three parts, so that Jubilee could graze one part, while another was growing for hay and for her winter feed. A farmer cut the hay for us, and we then did all the rest ourselves by hand, tossing and raking it, and taking it in barrow loads to near her shed, where we built it into a rick. Hay baling hadn't yet become the norm. It was hard work, but we pulled together and made a creditable little rick. As with the goats, we had plenty of entertaining experiences while caring for the cow, and for her calf later on, as when Sister Melanie had to fill in the forms required as part of keeping dairy cows. Name of owner, name of chief herdsman, number of cows in herd. Answer, 1. We had Jubilee for a number of years. She gave birth to a beautiful calf which we called Petra, and later on sold to a local farmer. It was when she had her second calf that she became ill. The birth had been quite normal, with our vet in attendance, and a few of us spending part of the night up there in the shed with her. The next morning she was lying down, which was very unusual. We called the vet again, and sadly he diagnosed milk fever. He did what he could, but was unable to save our lovely cow. She died with her head on my lap as I sat on the straw. We were all distressed, and there were unashamed tears on many faces. To see the knacker man come with his truck to collect her was cruel. There was, too, the problem of the bonny little bull calf waiting to be fed, but no mother. Sister Melanie rang a good friend who lived in Lancashire for advice. It was a long way off, but this kind man got straight into his car and drove over. He was a farmer, and had a foster mother ready for little Hubert, so he took him home. Knowing we were all upset, he had thoughtfully brought three baby goslings with him. "Try to rear these," he said. "They'll help you take your minds off Jubilee." They were tiny balls of greeny-yellow fluff. He explained that goslings are never easy to rear, but if we managed to keep one out of the three, we would be doing well. He had brought a bag of food for them for the first week or two, and after they'd finished that, they would be ready to live on grass, which was their staple diet. At Thicket, we'd had much experience in rearing chicks. Sister Catherine was put in charge of the three helpless little creatures, and I helped with any maintenance that they required. You might wonder what that entailed, but I assure you it was a surprising amount. First, we had to make a pen for them, wooden sides, netting top, and a little fox-proof shelter at the back for the night time. As all three goslings grew at an astonishing rate, we soon had to build bigger quarters for them, allowing them to roam the orchard during the day. They kept the grass down so well around the baby apple trees that it was like a bowling green. Never before nor since has it looked like that. They loved music, and when people were singing in the chapel, they listened with ecstatic attention, their long white necks stretched upwards, heads a little to one side. They got to know Sister Catherine's voice well, because she was usually the one who fed them. One hot summer's day, she had the window wide open in the office. She was prioress at the time. And when the phone rang, she stood by the window to answer it. The three geese heard her voice as she talked on the phone and thought she must be calling them. They came hurtling down from the orchard, half running and half flying, and landing hopefully outside her window. At Christmas time, the full-grown geese inevitably went, and we didn't keep livestock any more, apart from a couple of useful cats. We reverted to the paper cow, buying dried milk in a large paper sack for most uses, and a few bottles of fresh milk for tea and coffee, and for visitors. It worked out quite reasonably, and was less demanding of our time and energy. Around that time, we took up the making of Eucharistic wafers for churches, to supplement what we earned by our printing. This is fairly simple work, in which several of the sisters can share, and the demand is steady. So our time was taken up with getting this underway. Early in the 1980s, we had the sad experience of losing all the beautiful witch elms that had been a feature of our woodland. Dutch elm disease struck, as it did all over the country, and we had to have everyone felled. Some were huge, majestic trees that must have taken many years to attain so great a height and girth. Chainsaws roared and screamed throughout the woods, tractors ploughed through the undergrowth, until it all looked like a battlefield. When I heard the dull, cruel crump of those giant trees crashing to the ground, I used to bow my head in silent pain for a minute or two. Yet, if left unfelled, the elms would have died and blown down eventually, spreading the disease. It was explained to me that by felling them, before they had begun to rot, the timber would be saved and put to good use, but I still found it a sad experience. Most of our trees were cut up on the site into pit props, and were to be used in a coal mine quite far under the North Sea. The better trees were carted away on long trailers. When the man from the Forestry Commission was looking over the trees, he and I were walking along one of the woodland paths when he noticed a striped sapling. "I see you have deer," he said. "Oh, no," I replied confidently, "but we used to keep goats." He looked more closely at the sapling. "But this is freshly done," he maintained. "No, we don't have deer. We have foxes and badgers, but not deer," I answered with complete assurance. It was not long afterwards that Sister Rose was working in the woods and watched three graceful roe deer bounding along the woodland ride. As so often, I was wrong. Deer had indeed moved into the area and browsed in our own and the surrounding woods and fields. They have been part of our fauna ever since and never fail to give delight when we suddenly see them. They even come close to the house at times, and from the windows we have watched them feeding. For a while after the trees had gone, whole areas of the woods looked clear and bare. But with the sunlight now flooding the once shaded floor that had worn a carpet of dog's mercury and tway blades, all became inexorably an impenetrable mash of brambles. We are still working on the clearing and replanting process. Many ash and sycamore saplings came up without our aid. But there has been a lot to do as we help them through their younger stages. We love our woodlands and the wildlife they shelter. I have had magical moments meeting foxes, deer, squirrels, hares, plenty of rabbits too, but we are not quite so fond of these because of the skill they have in getting into our vegetable gardens. I could tell you many adventures concerning the badgers, including the saga of finding one of their sets had been tampered with, and subsequently catching the man digging there in broad daylight. The headline in the local paper ran, "Man digging badger set caught in act by nun." We were able to smile when we saw that, but in fact it was a very distressing experience. We had fondly imagined that the badgers were safe on our property. We knew only too well the cruelty the poor creatures undergo when they are caught. Now we realized that they were as vulnerable here as anywhere else, and so, for that matter, were we. Also of interest is our success with apple trees grown from pips. In our early days here, old Sister Raphael used to save the pips from her apples in the refectory. We would see her fumbling in her pocket during a meal and bringing out a little piece of paper in which she would carefully wrap the pips. Later on, they were planted in pots of soil, and then as the weeks went by, it was her delight to see the tiny seedlings emerge. It was a hobby she had, being a good gardener in her way, although somewhat unorthodox. I like to think that I too have had a share in those trees, because if she forgot to water them for a spell, I would give them a splosh as I passed by them, and as they grew larger, it was I who planted them in the nursery bed and kept an eye on their welfare. Ultimately, I planted them in the orchard. As the years passed, they began to bear fruit. A few were not very exciting, small and not much bigger than crab apples, so we scrapped them. But the majority produced splendid apples, each, of course, a brand new variety. Raphael saw the first two fruit before she died in 1982. Since then, the others have fruited, and so we are the proud possessors of some unique apples. One is a very early eater, another an early and large cooker, which becomes an eater as it ripens. Then there are some mid-season varieties, and perhaps the most useful of all, two very late keepers. This year we used the last of them in June. One of these days the trees may be worth propagating. All down the years we have steadfastly refused to use poisonous weed killers, sprays, or any other chemical substances that could endanger our tiny patch of countryside. Sometimes it's hard to resist the temptation to get rid of the weeds the easy way, but we prefer to know that our vegetables, fruit and flowers are free from poisons. It means we get a lot of green fly, caterpillars and slugs. But as we also love the wild birds, we feel we are providing a good habitat for them and for all the other wildlife around. And even when the slugs have done their bit, the pigeons theirs, and all the other hazards of a gardener's life have had their share, we still manage to produce good food for the community. After all, it isn't meant to be a show garden, although it's certainly an interesting one. The latest problem is deer eating the spinach, for which they have a great weakness. No wonder they look so healthy. Chapter 24. The Old Soldier. It was in the spring of 1977 that a phone message came from Ascot to say that Father was very poorly, and that Mother had had a fall and hurt her leg. They were in dire straits. I was cook at the time, and was busily kneading dough for the making of some fancy bread buns, for it was Easter Eve, and the morrow would be the festive day. Our prioress came into the kitchen to tell me of the call, and I saw at once that I would have to go and help them, since none of the others could do so. I rubbed the flour off my hands onto an apron, and ran downstairs to put a few oddments I might need into a bag. Meanwhile, the other sisters were making the necessary travel arrangements. In an incredibly short time, I was sitting in a train, speeding down the length of England to Bridgewater, where Julian was to meet me and drive me to Ascot. It was all like a dream, yet with heavy foreboding in it. The last time I had gone home, both parents had got well again quite soon, and on another occasion, when Bridget had gone, she, too, had managed to get them back onto their feet, even though they were not really in a fit condition to be living on their own and looking after themselves. Somehow they managed, and the local doctor kept her eye on them once a week. By the time we reached Bridgewater, it was much later than scheduled, and Julian was wondering what could have happened. He had his wife and baby son with him in the car. They had been with our parents during the afternoon, as it was Saturday, and he was not working. They felt that all would be well once I got there, someone to give them the care they needed at that difficult time. Mother's leg was not broken, but badly bruised and grazed, and she could only walk with difficulty. We were soon in the car, and Julian put me in the picture as we drove along. We dropped Judy and the baby at their cottage, at Stall, and sped on to Ashcott through those familiar villages. He had brought fish and chips to take home, so there would be some supper for us all. "Maybe Dad will perk up when he knows it's fish and chips," said Julian brightly. When we reached the old house, Julian went in a little ahead of me. His younger ears had caught something that mine had missed. It was Mother's voice talking. In a second he grasped what had happened. I followed him into my parents' room. Mother had put down the phone. Father was sitting in his accustomed chair, upright, dignified, his hand on his knee. But his brave spirit had slipped away. I went over and kissed his forehead. It was cold. "Is it certain, Ma?" Julian asked, a glimmer of hope lingering yet in his eye. "Yes, I think it is," I said softly. Then I put my hand on his knee, and my own hope gave a tiny flicker. "His knee is still warm. Perhaps..." And then I realized that the electric fire was on beside him, turned low. My heart had sunk again. It's the warmth from the fire. I put my hand on his shoulders, those strong, square shoulders that had carried me often enough long ago. I saw that there was still some of the bread dough around my nails. I hadn't had a proper wash since I had kneaded the buns on the kitchen table at Wood Hall. Mother had realized not long before our arrival that he was no longer breathing. She had been waiting anxiously for me to come. It was getting so much later than I had expected. Hardly knowing what she was doing, yet guided by that same sure instinct of wisdom that had helped her through so many difficult moments in the past, she had picked up the phone and rung Julian's cottage, hoping that he and I had at least got as far as that, and wanting us so much. It must have been at that very moment that we dropped Judy and the baby off, because she found the phone ringing when she opened the door and hastened to answer it. "I think something terrible has happened." Mother's voice was enough without the words. Judy then did a very sensible thing. "Just keep talking to me, Mum. It doesn't matter what you say. Say anything, just keep talking. Jew and Mari will be with you any moment." So that's what Mother was doing when we came into the house. She was very brave. As yet, her grief had not fully taken hold of her. She and I went into the other room while Julian rang the doctor and undertaker. In moments like this, God gives us strength we could never have found in ourselves. I knew that Mother ought to be having some food because she was a diabetic on insulin and had been under great strain. I remembered the fish and chips. Always a celebration meal for her, as for Father. We warmed them up, and she managed to eat a little, so that was one of my worries eased. The doctor had been at the house earlier in the day, but hadn't guessed how near the end Father was. He had just slipped away. Like the old soldiers in the song he used to sing, he had faded away. It always used to upset Mother when he sang that song, in his lovely tenor voice, pausing on the top note. Throughout her married life, Mother had known that in all probability he would go before her, as he was 18 years her senior. But he had been doing so well, and at 86 had still been as mentally alert as ever. The very evening before, he had been carrying on a deeply involved discussion with Julian. It had looked possible that they would reach their golden wedding, which was only a matter of months away. But we are never prepared for what we dread, and it is as well. When the moment comes, It is time enough to bear it, without having tried to anticipate the pain. We rang the rest of the family, or rather Julian did, while I stayed with Mother. We did ordinary things like feeding the cat and bird, and arranging for the night. She couldn't walk very well with her damaged leg. I fixed the bandage, trying to make it more comfortable. Somehow caring for the lesser wound distracted our minds from the great one. Julian carried her bed on his back up the twisty stairs and put it beside the one I was to sleep in. I ran up to see if he needed help. He didn't need it with the bed, but both he and I needed to be alone together for a few moments. We let our tears flow and held each other very close. "He's been more ill than that so often," he said, "but he's always been able to pull through." I don't remember my answer, if there was one. We dried our faces and went back downstairs. I had a kind of feeling that once she saw our tears, Mother's would begin, but I couldn't imagine how they would ever end. But I had misjudged her courage. She was an example to us both. Then Julian went home to his cottage and family, and we went up to bed. Very early the next morning, Julian's car came back down the road. Neither he nor I had been able to sleep. Later on, Boo and her husband came, and in the afternoon, Simon. It was Easter Sunday, the day of resurrection, surely the most fitting day of the whole year to be thinking in terms of new life and the resurrection of everyone. Yet my heart was too full of sorrow to be able to see beyond to that. In the kitchen, on the windowsill behind the sink that Julian had recently put in, was a jam jar containing the pussy willows whose children had brought for Father the previous Sunday, the pussy palms of the countryside. He always had a special love for them and for Palm Sunday, and we in consequence have shared it. It was a poignant moment when I saw the silvery buds there on that morning. I stayed on at Ashcott for some weeks, helping Mother to get her life onto some kind of an even keel. Her leg got better with time and care, but she had aged a lot. We were all anxious about her being alone in that rather rambling house, particularly at night, but she wanted to stay there. So in the end I came away, but it was with some misgiving. While in Ashcott, I had seen more changes in the village since my previous visit about 8 years before. More and more bungalows had sprung up and new roads made where fields had been. In my growing years, I can only recall 2 bungalows in the whole village. Many more of the people I had known and who had been part of my life for years were now laid to rest in the quiet churchyard where we buried Father's body. I love that Walt Whitman poem, where he says that all the people he had known, and all the things he had seen and heard and understood, had become part of him, and he part of them. I felt the truth of this very much when I walked around that little churchyard, and when I heard the church bells ringing on the Sunday morning. It, they, all were part of me, as I was then, and as I am now. One thing I learned at the time was how important it is to write to people we know when they have suffered a bereavement. Before that, when faced with writing such a letter, I had always feared to write it, lest I should put my clumsy foot where angels would fear to tread, and cause even more pain to the dear person to whom I was writing. Once I'd been tempted not to write at all, and hoped that my silence would be interpreted as a sensitive respect, or the effect of my having been too deeply saddened to be able to find words. When I saw how much the letters of condolence which Mother received meant to her, although they brought tears, I realized it is far better to write in such cases, even when we can't find words that seem suitable. Frequently, in any case, they are more suitable than we imagine, because we have tried and thought and often prayed beforehand. And however clumsy they may be, they show that at least we have attempted, in our poor way, to express our sympathy. for the recipient at that moment, that is all that's needed. Mother carried on in the old home for a while, but it was quite unsatisfactory. There were so many steps up and down to the rooms, and before long she had another fall. It wasn't serious, although she could not get up for some hours. After a lot of agonizing, for her and for us all, she moved into a little bungalow further up the hill on which Ashcott is built, and Julian and his family went to live in the old home. They were very near and could visit often. The rest of us kept in touch by telephone, and she courageously set about starting her life anew as a widow in unfamiliar surroundings. She had to leave behind many of her well-loved pieces of furniture, gathered so slowly over the years. But Mother was sensible, and knew that now all her family had gone, her needs were few, and easily fulfilled. She had her piano, and several music people still coming regularly, although about that time her fingers became curled with arthritis, and she was not able to play any more. At first she could a little, but the result of her efforts was so frustrating to her, now that she realized her beloved Beethoven and Mozart were now no longer possible for her, and her nimble fingers had seized up. However, she had her television and watched out for musical programs, which always gave her a great joy. Her dog, Katie, and Miskin, the long-haired silver and white Persian cat, both of which she and father had had from puppy and kittenhood, were great companions for her now. She had always had someone to care for. Now she still had these two pets to feed and look after. In fact, Katie, a very intelligent bitch of no known breed, but with a most loving nature, really helped to look after her. She kept an eye on Mother's every movement, and if she thought her mistress was not very well, she would stay close by her all the time, even going to the bathroom with her, as if to make sure she was safe. When Mother could no longer get in the bath, or in any way reach to wash her feet, she would sit on the edge of the bed in the early morning and ask Katie to wash them for her. Katie would sit and lick all over her feet and ankles, up to where Mother could reach, with her rough pink tongue. It was one of her regular duties. Once in a way, the chiropodist from the health service would come and give the feet a wash with water, or one of the family would do the job for her. Those days, Katie had a morning off. Mother lived alone in the bungalow with her little garden, which she loved, for about 10 years. None of us felt very happy about her being on her own, particularly as she was diabetic, but it was the only way. She was a very independent lady, and all of us were totally committed either to our families or to our monastic communities. Most of the time she managed surprisingly well, with the help of a number of good people. A home help came once a week, and a lady from the street used to come over and do some jobs in the house and garden, bringing fish and chips, which she and Mother much enjoyed for their lunch. The tradesmen always called and passed the time of day. She knew them all, and they knew her needs. 2 days a week she had Meals on Wheels, a wonderful service. On one occasion, Julian brought his little son George, then about 2 or 3 years old, to spend the morning with Granny while he and Judy went shopping. "He can share your meal on wheel," he told her, knowing that this was usually ample. It was one of Mother's great gifts that she was so good with children of any age, and they always loved her. She seemed to know just how to talk to them. Many were the surprising little confidences they would elect to share with her. On that morning, George and his granny had a happy time together, playing his favourite games. And then at 12 o'clock she told him that they must get the table laid ready for lunch because of the Meals on Wheels would soon be arriving. Together they put on the tablecloth and collected plates and spoons, and George clambered onto a chair in the adroit way small children have of wriggling up onto the seat with their tummies first and then swivelling around. Then the car drew up at the door, and a lady came in with the piping hot meal in foil dishes, which she set on the table, smiling at Mother's small guest, and then hurrying off to her next visit. Mother served up the food onto both their plates, while George watched in grave silence. Then he looked up at with a puzzled expression in his big dark eyes. "Where are the wheels, Granny?" he said. Chapter 25. The Sycamore Buds. Our Carmel at Wood Hall went through a difficult time when the Ecumenical Centre had to close down, for lack of funds, and the big house was put on the market. We had no idea what its new purpose might be, or whether it would prove impractical for us to remain there. A great deal of heart-searching went on. At one point we thought of moving elsewhere in Yorkshire. Later there was the possibility of joining forces with another Carmel that was just being founded. We even began to think about what could be taken with us. I was very keen to dig up and replant, in the new place, at least two of the apple trees from our now so promising orchard. We prayed, discussed, asked advice, agonized over what to do for the best. And then gradually we came to the conclusion that we would remain where we were, unless the centre premises were used for some quite incompatible purpose. The time of uncertainty lasted for several years. For a short time, while the centre still belonged to the diocese, it was used as a reception centre for Vietnamese boat people. Families were brought there on arrival in England while homes were being found for them. It was a place where they could get some kind of rest and feeling of stability after the terrible trauma they had lived through, many of them for months and even years. Some were able to be reunited with other members of their families. The staff did everything they could to help them readjust, and lots of local people gave whatever assistance they were able to offer. Some gave English lessons, some provided clothing, and later utensils, as homes were found for them. It was a moving and humbling experience to witness the courage and cheerfulness of these new neighbours. The little children were beautiful. Often they would run up to our front door and play around. Eventually the big house became a hotel, and a very quiet one, so there was no further need for anxiety on that score. The cottages belonging to it, which would in years gone by have been staff dwellings for the stately home, became private houses and were developed and improved. This made Wood Hall into almost a little hamlet, which was good. The Carmel, the hotel, and the families in the cottages, although not always impinging on one another, are mutually supportive in times of need. Sometimes the steep lane to the village and outside world becomes blocked by ice and snow. Once we had a sister who was very ill at such a time, and a man from one of the cottages managed to get out with a four-wheel drive vehicle and collect medication for her. At other times we have been able to supply or lend items to help the hotel or one of the families. Meanwhile, back at Thicket, new members had arrived, so the empty cells we had left were filled again. Some of the older sisters died and were laid to rest in the cemetery there, but even so the community soon regained the size it had been before we left to found Wood Hall. In time Bridget became the prioress, so she had a lot of work on her hands, but she had grown into a calm, sensible person with great breadth of mind, a warm heart, and a good sense of humour, so she coped well. She also retained, and still has, a youthfulness and lightness of touch, which have helped both her and the other sisters over many a difficult time. I went to Ascot again in 1988, when Mother had a bad chest infection and pneumonia was feared. Despite her protestations, she simply had to have help, if only for a few days. I found her much more frail and beginning to be forgetful. It was all very worrying. She didn't want to go into a home, and even if she had wanted it, none of the others would have been happy about it. And then Julian and his wife decided they would build a granny flat onto the old house, where she had lived for so many happy years. And until it was ready, she should go and live with them in a bedsitter on the ground floor. Julian was a man of many gifts. He designed the extension himself, hired a JCB to level the land, and built with his own hands a lovely two-roomed flat with its own shower and toilet adjoining the house. A door from his kitchen gave access, but Mother also had her own front door and patch of garden outside. The whole blended in well with the old house, because he used the same local stone and pantiled the roof. I stayed with her only a little while, until she was over the infection, and then Julian took her to his house after I had returned to Yorkshire. He built the extension within a few months, but unfortunately Mother had a fall, crossing the uneven flagstones of the courtyard, and broke her hip. We all feared she would not recover from the operation. Diabetics have extra problems, and she was 80. However, with good nursing at the hospital, she pulled through and began to walk again with the aid of a Zimmer frame. She had always had plenty of pluck, and this hadn't left her. Not only did she recover from that operation, but within a few months she had a cataract removed from one eye. This had been planned for a long time. Her sight had been getting very poor. Reading had always been a lifeline for her, far more than television. Simon had been getting her large print books from the library, and these had been a great help. But by the time she was 80, even these had become difficult for her to read. An incident that occurred a year or so before this is illustrative of her spirit, even in frail old age. One of the family had sent her a length of pretty pink material, with the suggestion that it be made into curtains for her bedroom. Mother told me of its arrival during a chat on the phone. "It's far too pretty to be made into curtains," she said firmly. "I'm going to make it into a sundress. I've never had a sundress, and I've often wished I had." And sure enough, although the stitches were a far cry from her former neat sewing, and I think someone helped her to machine the sides, she made herself a sundress. I don't suppose she had much wear out of it, but it gave her pleasure to feel that she could still run up a garment. After the cataract operation, she had to wait some time for the new glasses, but even without them she could see a lot better than before. She looked forward to getting them, and ordered a weekly magazine, and she bought two new books, one of them a wildflower book, so that she could improve her knowledge of the local flora. She told me that when her glasses came, she was planning to put a face on. She had never worn makeup of any kind. Hers was the clear pink and white complexion that needed no assistance from the chemists. But some of the younger members of the family had persuaded her to buy a lipstick and some other makeup, now that she had recovered to a certain extent from two operations. The arrival of the new glasses was to be the signal for the new face to appear. But it was not to be. Before they had even come, early one morning, quite unexpectedly, she died, so she never wore her makeup. On the evening before, she had phoned me, as bright as can be, and we had a good chat. One of the things she said was, "I've spoken to all my children today." And as things turned out, I was so grateful that we had all had that last happy contact with her. Also on that last day, Julian had, on the spur of the moment, taken a snapshot of her sitting outside her new little domain, wearing a pretty summer dress and her beads. She loved beads, and Father had always loved to see her wearing them. On the day she died, a little later in the day, Julian dashed into street and got the photo developed. He slipped a copy into each of four envelopes and got them straight into the post, so that we each received one on the following morning. It was such a lovely thought. We had all loved and revered Mother all our lives, as we had Father. Even now we find ourselves doing things and coping with unexpected situations as she would have done. She lives on in the daily living of each of our lives, and we treasure the memory of a noble woman and loving mother. I wasn't able to go down to Somerset for her funeral, but spent the day quietly at Wood Hall, sharing in my heart with those of the family who were there, all, in fact, except Bridget and me. I sat in the woods almost all day long, silently bearing the pain of loss and praying for them all. The sycamore trees were just opening their leaf buds and scattering the little pink sheaths all over the ground like confetti. Mother would have appreciated this. She always loved pink. And the newly opened buds spoke to me of new life and the resurrection. However old we are when we lose a dear parent, it is still as hard. The sisters were all very understanding and supportive, but I was grateful for their kindness. Over the ensuing weeks, Mother's bungalow was sold and the money shared between us. It was a sad day for me when I saw the solicitor's envelope with the letters. It somehow seemed so final, so crushing. I just didn't want to look inside it or have anything to do with the contents. Fortunately for me, the situation was eased in that I didn't have to cope with it immediately. In a community, there is always someone at hand whose work is to attend to the various details of everyday life for the others. Finances were not my area of competency, so I could hand over the envelope until I had been able to come to terms with my present lot. Later, I was very happy to find that Mother's legacy had enabled us to buy, at long last, a small but very suitable electronic organ for our chapel. She would greatly have approved of the purchase. It also paid to have some roof lights put in, which made the main passage bright and cheerful. It had always been rather dark. A little incident regarding these was not lost on me. The joiners had come to measure up and discuss the job, and then we waited and waited and wondered if they would ever come to do the work. Then one day they arrived, and to our surprise got it all done in one day, three lovely big windows, and I noticed that it was the anniversary of my parents' wedding day.